This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Neil LaBute first became known for writing and directing plays and movies about mean-spirited, manipulative sexual relationships. As Jennifer Egan wrote about him, he has made a career of dissecting sexual betrayal with an emphasis on the ease with which the deceitful prey on the trusting. This is not the type of subject matter you'd expect from a graduate of Brigham Young, the Mormon University in Utah, and it certainly wasn't subject matter the university approved of. Before we go any further, let me play you what the actor Aaron Eckhart told me earlier this year about performing in LaBute's plays back when Eckhart was a student at Brigham Young and LaBute was a graduate student there.
It's one of those things when we would do plays there, they would lock the theater before. So they would take away the light board and we'd be scheduled to have a run, at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock for a week. And Neil would call me up literally after rehearsing for 3 months and be like, we can't do it. We have to do it at 8 o'clock in the morning and tell all your friends. So we would kind of do this commando one-time theater performance.
We're going to talk with Neil LaBute about why he's created misogynistic and misanthropic characters and how he reconciled that with his faith when he was a Mormon. LaBute is a playwright, screenwriter, and director whose movies include In the Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbors, and this summer's remake of the 1973 horror film The Wicker Man. He also directed a couple of films that seemed kind of out of character, the comedy Nurse Betty and the adaptation of the A.S. Byatt novel Possession. LaBute wrote and directed the new one-man show Rex, starring Ed Harris, at Open Tuesday at the Public Theater in New York. Neil LaBute, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your new play.
The easiest way to describe it is a kind of eulogy in a way. A man has lost his wife of well over 30 years. Actually, they'd been married about 35 years, and it is at the viewing of his wife, and the entire show takes place in a very theatrical kind of setting, which is that he's meant to be in the other room, and through his dialogue we learn that he is with us in the theater in his mind. He's escaping for both a cigarette and to work out the complicated history that they've shared.
I want to quote the New Yorker theater critic John Lahr. In an article about you, he wrote, "He brings to his observations about human nature something that other contemporary American writers have not articulated with such single-minded authority, a sense of sin." Do you agree that you're interested in a sense of sin?
It would be silly if I disagreed with John Lahr, frankly. Whether it's a good or bad quote, I certainly do have that interest. I think it has been there for a long time. Before I really could consider myself a writer, and before and after the period where I was affiliated with any particular church, say the Mormon church, where I was a member for a number of years, I think just the greater sense of morality, good and bad, and the idea of sin is in fact interesting to me and probably weighs, not heavily, but weighs certainly into the equation every time that I write. There's a desire to go back to that question. I think those are simple questions that sometimes get forgotten to be, or I don't know if that was articulated well, but they're not always asked because they seem perhaps too simple. But I think they're always worth asking. The idea of, and sometimes I've done it as simply as that, as a character saying, "Do you think you're good?" or "What is good?" What is right and wrong? Or am I a bad person? They're interesting because they're so subjective, and that's what's interesting to me. I'm very much a person who's into the idea of subjectivity and why it, is such an interesting filter through which to look at art and life, and so I do go back to those questions repeatedly.
I want to ask you to choose a scene from one of your plays or movies that you think is very potent in terms of transgressing, in terms of crossing a line into something that you consider, really, really bad or sinful.
Well, I think that probably a scene from In the Company of Men, which was written a while ago now, almost a decade. But In the Company of Men, I think, was based on a very cruel premise because it was very calculated. And two men, if a listener doesn't know it, that story, it's two men decide to seduce a coworker and simultaneously date her, building up her confidence, and then dump her when they leave town because they're on an assignment. And there's a scene late in the film that Aaron Eckhart plays. His character's name is Chad, and he's sitting with the young woman who has realized what's happening, and she confronts him. And Aaron performed a kind of textbook of male slipperiness, I guess is the right word. It's, you know, you watch this guy go through so many phases of trying to deny what the truth is, from smiling to trying to sympathize with her to saying that he's, you know, this isn't the truth, that there's all of these movements through which he goes to where he finally makes himself laugh and says, I can't keep a straight face. And you see the complexity with which this guy's mind works. And I think that is a scene that people have often referred to in terms of the kind of laser-like devotion I will give to the intricacies of how people can manipulate and destroy one another, even in the name of love sometimes.
Neil LaBute, why are you interested in creating characters whose goal is to manipulate, tear people apart, and destroy them?
Well, I guess it's fascinating because I know that we do have that capacity. I mean, we have such capacity for good and equally a capacity for great ill. And as a writer, as a, you know, certainly a fiction writer, you look to create conflict. You're constantly spoiling people's day and their parties, and you're looking for a reason that people start throwing china and walking out of the room. And so to me, to find people at that, you know, these often intimate groups of people, friends, lovers, coworkers, who some at the heart of their relationships is some betrayal, and how they deal with that feeling of having been betrayed by someone you're intimate with is quite fascinating. And so I think that I'm often drawn to where a relationship can tumble to.
Now, you converted to the Mormon faith when you were how old?
I was in college, so I was, you know, in my 20s.
And you got a scholarship at Brigham Young University, which is a Mormon college. Did you convert after you got admitted there?
Yes. I went to the school as a non-member. I had a scholarship and I was studying there. And it was during the time that I was studying as an undergraduate that I joined the church.
It was interesting because, like, you joined the church just in time to write plays that completely undermine all the principles the church stands for. So why, like, could you explain that that paradox?
No, I can't actually. Be, you know, if I could, I would not be necessarily a rich man, but I might be a more complete man. It's something that eventually drove me in some ways from the church. I think I found myself trying to balance my creative world and this religious idea on the other side, where, you know, the church has very definite views about how art should be, what art is, in fact, and then how it should be used. And I think I had different ideas about that, but felt that I could justify my work. And ultimately, I was, you know, making R-rated films when the church asks you to not see them. And so there's a point where you have to look yourself in the mirror and say, are you just self-justifying, or is it really the truth? And ultimately, the truth was I couldn't do both.
I know you taught film ethics at Brigham Young University, and I'd like you to describe what some of those ethics were that you taught, and also how it helped you, if it helped you, figure out what lines you wanted to cross and why, and what you thought the purpose of art is and why.
It was an interesting class in that I thought it did ask some strong and interesting questions, particularly ones that were intriguing for people who were essentially going to a religious school. You know, that it asked realistic questions in that these are things that you might have to face one day beyond, you know, would you remove your clothing to be in a scene if you saw that you were going to be paid for this, you know, acting work? Or it went to questions about, you know, the nature of politically, you know, how would you face, you know, a piece of material? Or do you think it's right to even work in this particular medium or another medium as opposed to one that you're more drawn to, but you need to pay the bills? You know, it asks kind of moral and ethical questions, which are always good to ask. And I find no problem entertaining someone at the same time handing them over, you know, questions that I don't have an answer to. And that's part of the dialogue that you share with them during the show that happens in Rex, which we're doing right now. There are questions there that I don't necessarily have answers to but I have opinions on, but it's not me raising the question so I can then jam my answer down the throat of an audience member, but to say, this is what is curious to me. This is what is keeping me up. And what do you think of this? You know, is one of the great questions in that play, I think, is what is love in a general way? But can someone really have loved a person that they've lied to for essentially their entire relationship? That's not a question that I feel the need to answer so much as to raise and see where that leaves an audience at the end of a show. So I think those are the kinds of things that I was trying to ask those students, you know, some years ago and keep trying to ask an audience today, that the big questions that roll around in my head.
I'm really curious, because we're talking here about the time when you were a Mormon and at Brigham Young University and writing plays that were considered very transgressive there. I'm wondering what you think of the controversies now about art that depicts the Prophet Muhammad, whether it's, an opera, you know, a Mozart opera in Germany or the cartoons that sparked the riots. I figure this is something you've thought about.
No, I hadn't actually heard about this. No, I'm kidding. Sure, I think about it, and I find it really interesting. It's to me, I've seen the cartoons, and I've read about the opera and what that particular scene is. I don't have any of the preoccupations or worries that other people might have about that. It's not my faith either, and so I'm not one to say that that's a silly sense that they're in the wrong, but in terms of art, I'm a bit of an anything goes person, and that can be dangerous or frivolous, but it tends to be the way I feel. In a smaller way, we have a because we're essentially, even though we're in the mind of a man in Rex, we're in a funeral home, and we hand out prayer cards at the beginning of the show. And I've already received emails from a couple of people saying that they find that offensive, that it shouldn't be used as some kind of a prop, and it's not a site-specific kind of play. And so why are we handed this thing that they feel is more sacred than we're letting on? And so you have to respond to that kind of thing. But I'm not having to respond to the theater being burned down. There's a point where the thermidor that comes from that, the reaction is so strong that that's all you can react to. And so there's no dialogue really about, the right or wrong of the action or the reaction. It all comes down to, people are being killed and the Pope says something and a nun is killed. So we have to respond to the most violent or sensational part of that. So it becomes difficult to actually talk about the act itself.
Now, before you actually left the Mormon Church, they disfellowed you, is I think the expression.
I was disfellowshipped. Yes,
disfellowshipped. Yes, which is like a decrease in status within the church.
It's a kind of limbo, I suppose. Really, it's not a excommunication. It's there are certain things that come with it. You can't take the sacrament. You can't hold a church office. But it's a place where they're hoping that you'll work your way back toward good standing in the church as opposed to the other direction.
And what was there a specific cause for that disfellowship?
My being disfellowshipped came directly as a result of the play Bash, which I had done. Some members of the church had sent in materials and their concern to the offices in Salt Lake and the local authorities in the church had asked me to come in and speak about it. And I think that ultimately they understood that I was not trying to create a negative image for the church, but it was I completely understood their feelings about it in that someone might see a review of a play and the title of it could be Murderous Mormons, and that could be their first contact with the Mormon Church at all, so that they had great concern over that. And
I should mention here that in that play, There's, I think, a couple of Mormons who beat up a gay person.
There are three different plays in that piece, and there are a couple of incidences of infanticide, and then there is, yeah, there's a gay bashing in there as well. And so I think that they were duly concerned over the depiction of activities that were perpetrated by characters who had some affiliation with the church. And so ultimately in the end I was disfellowshipped, and it's a place that I remained or a status rather that I remained at until my resignation from the church.
There was an article about you a while ago in the New York Times by Mim Udovich, and she had been asking you about the kind of manipulative, exploitive men who you've created as characters in your work. And you said to her that you grew up around men who have been quite difficult, and I was wondering, like, who you had in mind.
President Nixon, I guess. An old family friend. No, my father was a tricky character. He was a really intriguing blend of, you know, handsome and could be funny, and yet he was a person who was quicksilver in terms of the way he his tempers went. And he was a truck driver, so he was often gone, and you never knew how he was going to come through the door, if he was going to be happy or angry or sad, and so he was someone who, I mean, it's such a strong figure in your life, and he created a real sense of danger, I think, in the household. So I think a lot of those stronger male figures who are calculated and frankly a little bit scary have probably no doubt come from my experiences around him.
When you say that your father turned the house into a dangerous atmosphere, are you saying that he actually physically hurt your mother or you?
There were times where there was, it's funny today what gets called abuse as opposed to, people say, oh, that I used to get spanked, and now they call it abuse. And so it's a kind of ever movable feast in terms of what people call it. But yeah, there were times where he was physically aggressive as well as emotionally or verbally. So that was always a possibility. It was certainly something that he did far less than just the kind of pervasive sense of menace that was in the air. You know, the first time I read a Pinter play, I kind of said, "Hey, that's like my place." You know, there was always a kind of this hanging pause in the air that you thought this could really go either way. Whatever you know has been said or done here, you never knew really how the man would react.
Because your movies are about gender conflict in some way, and because some of the men in your films are so like misogynistic in their own way and certainly anti-feminist, people will wonder, what are your gender politics? Like, do you think of yourself as anti-feminist, or are these just characters you create to reflect on the things happening in society?
I'm a creature of what I do. For me, it's all about, I'm a writer. I'm looking to entertain. I'm looking to provoke. I mean, I don't just always want to go out there and cause a stir. But you know, it's part of the job. And I feel like for me, I'm much more hopeful than a lot of my characters. I'm certainly more of what I would think of as a humanist in terms of, you know, giving everybody a relatively fair break and hoping for the best. But I also am quite realistic and realize the great, you know, capacity we have for good and bad. But frankly, you know, the bad is often just the more interesting thing to write. It's you can ask any number of actors and they'll say, yeah, it's pretty fun to play the bad guy. They get all the good lines. Well, you get to write those good lines when you're writing somebody who's that way. So for me, it's a label, particularly the misogynistic one, that stuck early to In the Company of Men, and I think it kind of unfairly stuck there. When I finally did get women to see the film, I think they looked at it and thought it was a pretty interesting take on the office and the way men and women sometimes mm-hmm. interact. So labels are what they are. I don't worry much about them, but it's always about, you know, how do you get the word out, and for me as a person, it has very little to do with who I am, mm-hmm. the things mm-hmm. that I write.
I know somebody who's been very influential on you as a writer is David Mamet. Could you describe what it is about his writing that is most important to you?
Yeah, it's good. You know, he gets it. He influenced me, you know, again at a time where I was very ready to be influenced, and I was coming from a place from Spokane, Washington, from Central Valley High School. And I didn't have a lot of access to new modern work, and Brigham Young was not a place where I was going to find that either. But you stumble onto a play or two, and one of the plays that I happened to get in my hands at an early age was Sexual Perversity in Chicago, and I thought it opened a whole new world in terms of what could be said. The way that characters could be approached. You know, I'm sure it was not unlike for some people, you know, 100 and some years ago, when they see artists beginning to make workers in the field their you know, point of reference in terms of a painting rather than royalty or you know, landscapes, that it was, you know, anything is the possibility for fodder for subject matter, and the way in which he dealt with language, the kind of muscular writing that he was doing. And the way he tackled subjects, and that things could end unhappily, and certainly plays have ended unhappily before that. But there was such a modern heartbeat in that stuff for me that I'm sure it was not unlike someone sitting in the royal court and watching John Osborne's Look Back in Anger, you know, or seeing Brando on stage for the first time and going, "Damn, what is that? That's I'm not used to this."
You know, in some of your work, people speak to each other. People describe to each other sexual relationships that they've had and how they've used people. Did you have to lose any inhibitions as a writer to be able to get there in your work?
No, I think that, you know, that's the place that I still reserve for the most freedom that I feel as a person. That there are inhibitions that I probably have as a person that I don't feel as a writer. And that's part of that anything goes that I'd mentioned earlier. That to me, it's a, you know, it's really kind of open season that if this is not the place in which to talk about anything, that it's, I think the theater is still a place where ideas are king or queen or whatever you want to call them. It's a kind of open forum for talking about anything we sort of damn well please. And I think that I don't remember the quote exactly, but there was I think it was attributed to Flaubert for him saying something to the effect of, I live my life simply or quietly so that I can write savagely. And I think that, again, I don't pull from my own life because I don't find it that interesting. And I mean, I'm not that interested in it, so why would somebody else be? I don't feel like the stories that come from me, and if they deal, you know, I have to be, once I decide on a story and I'm going to write that story, I have to be true to that story and to those characters. And I'm much more worried about telling that story properly than I am in how the audience will find it, whether they'll feel it's I mean, I want it to be compelling, but I don't really care if it ends happily or if it caters to anything that they appreciate or have been brought up believing. You know, our audiences today are so used to things working out and the folks who have done bad getting what they deserve. Yeah, it's based on bedtime stories that were altered from the original in the first place. And so it's just a kind of, I don't even know that they want it. It's just what they're used to. So for me, that when I get a chance to work in the theater or write, it's I'm gonna be careful about being honest to what I set out to do, as opposed to catering to the whims of an audience.
Well, Neil LaBute, good luck with your new play, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Neil LaBute's new one-man show, Rex, opened in New York this week. It stars Ed Harris.